Good afternoon. It's my pleasure today to welcome Andrew Sims, who is a partial graduate of our program, having gotten his master's in biomedical and health informatics, currently working on his PhD with a prior background in computer science, experience in industry, working in software design and development. And since he's got a lot of slides, I'll turn it over to him and let him go into detail about his presentation and more background on Andrew is in the handout, which is circulating. So thanks very much.
Great. Thanks, Peter. All right. I'll try to keep things moving along. Let me start by giving an overview of what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to give a little bit of background on the research that goes on in the Daggett Lab. I'm going to give an introduction to online analysis processing, or OLAP, which is one of the methods that I'll be talking about today. After the introduction, I'm going to go into some details. Next, I'm going to talk about a cube design that I've made for storing the information that we create in the Daggett Lab. Then I'll follow it up with some implementation results based on what I've been able to put in and get out of it. And finally, I'll wrap up with some conclusions, and there should be time for questions at the end. Okay, background. So the Daggett Lab has two major areas of focus. One is studying of disease-related proteins, and the second project being Dynamiomics. It's a bioinformatics project to classify structures. All of the work in the lab is primarily computational, although we have people that do have wet lab components to their research. Both areas of focus are really all about protein motion. And we've just put an article out in Structure last week, and we've revised our website. So if you want to learn more about the Daggett Lab and what we do, I encourage you to check out the article and go to the website. So I mentioned there are two halves to the lab. Where they come together is in using a method called molecular dynamic simulation. This is a method for giving us atomic resolution structure and dynamics for proteins. And much like the pictures below, we start with a static structure that gives us a little bit of information about what this protein is and what it can do. But the static structure, we can determine some things, but we can't really tell what it's going to do when it starts moving. So for that, we do simulation. So starting with a static structure from the protein data bank, we surround it with a solvent, typically water. We do a little bit of prep work. And then finally, we let the classical mechanics in our simulation engine give us an idea of what things will happen when things start moving. And much like these old flip books of trying to determine if a horse's hooves can all four leave at the same time, we can capture that sort of information out of simulations. You're going to be seeing this table a lot today, so I'm not going to talk about it too much, but these are examples of the type of data that the simulation engine produces. Okay, so that's one simulation. What do we get out of it? First of all, we get a lot of coordinates, three-dimensional coordinates for each atom in the protein and in the solvent around it. But for the standpoint of the database, we're really only looking at the protein coordinates. Secondly, we started with a single structure. Running a simulation under one of our standard protocols will give us about 31 times 10 to the third structures. So we start with that one, we end up with a lot more. And again, 29 million sets of coordinates, 31,000 structures. When we actually put this into SQL, it's about 4.4 gigabytes of data in a single table. A set of analysis tables that go around another 600 megabytes worth of data. Again, one simulation. But we've done a lot more than one simulation. To date, we're at right now at about 2,070 targets. This is the mountain of data that I'm talking about today. Peter mentioned that I did my master's in the program. That was in 2007, and this is when I first started working on this data. Focus then was primarily about storage and a little bit about how to organize it to make it usable. Back then, we only had 2,300 simulations, about 300 distinct proteins. 50 million structures total, and the total size of the SQL database at the time that I graduated was 24 terabytes. Things have moved on since then. We've run a lot more simulations, and we put a lot more in the database. Really now the emphasis has switched. Since we've got so much data, organization is key, analysis is key. And those are the two areas that I've been working on the most, but specifically today, I'm going to talk about analysis. And for that, we're going to talk about online analysis processing. So let me give you a brief introduction. Online analysis processing, or analytical processing, is a term coined by Ted Codd. He's the inventor of the relational database. The paper is a set of principles. Unlike his relational papers that talk about the mathematics and so forth, this was more of a white paper, if you would. It's a set of principles that basically posit that the type of database needed for doing analysis, very different from, in this case, the relational model that he was working on to do analysis. High-level concepts in OLAP. Two things to remember, and you'll hear these throughout the talk today. Data are organized around facts and dimensions. Facts are continuous measurements on an item of interest. Again, going back to this table, these are the XYZ coordinates for the atoms in a simulation. Those are facts. Dimensions are discrete quantities that classify measurements into useful groupings. The other columns in the table, typically I'll be using a blue color for those today, but things like atom numbers, struct IDs, simulation IDs, those are all dimensions. Okay, getting into a little more detail. If I look at just one of these columns, atom number, you can see that atom number one is associated with this triple of points. And in a sense, atom number is one dimension in this model. Another dimension is the simulation dimension. I mentioned we have 10,000 simulations. Every one of them has a number. And so at the intersection of simulation 678 and atom number one, again for this limited set, you end up with one set of coordinates. So these two things together, you know, form a coordinate system in themselves, linking you to the fact data that you want to analyze. Using multiple dimensions gives the total organizational model of something that's called a hypercube. And so thus, you usually refer to OLAP cubes as the database term of choice. A collection of facts and related dimensions form a cube. You can implement this cube concept using any database backend. In a relational database, you end up with a schema that looks something like this, where you have your facts in the middle and they're surrounded by dimensional tables. But what I'm going to be talking about today is a multidimensional implementation of this. Okay, so multidimensional OLAP. MOLAP is the abbreviation for multidimensional OLAP. And it specifically refers to an implementation of an analysis engine that is optimized for multidimensional storage. We'll talk a little bit more about how this contrasts with a relational model that you may be more familiar with. And then also specifically today, there are a number of products that make this offering, but I'm going to be talking about SQL Server Analysis Services as the MOLAP model that I've been working on. Two parts of, and again, we'll cover this more later. In addition to the storage engine, it also has its own language called multidimensional expressions, or MDX, and again, we'll cover that a little bit more. So that's the overview of OLAP. Now let's get into the details. So you'll recall that dimensions uniquely identify facts. So dimensions are composed of discrete values, and you'll hear the word member a lot today. Those are the values on the number line. Fact data basically can be addressed by taking all of those members in each dimension, each associated dimension, and that will bring you to a given fact. One difference between members, and you may be wondering what's the difference between a fact and a dimension, since they seem to have some, other than being continuous and discontinuous, they're similar. Members also have the ability to be hierarchically organized, and we'll see that too in this next example. So let's talk about basically a model for organizing protein information. Protein is a long string composed of amino acid side chains. At the very bottom level, you have the individual atoms that are part of an amino acid. You have the amino acid itself. This comes from the PDB, this notion that crystallographers, when they're making structures, will crystallize different chains, and they'll include that all in one major model. Most of the time when we're looking at our simulations, we're looking at the first chain, but I still capture that piece of knowledge in the model so that we can link back to the protein data bank. So key points here, the entire hierarchy is the dimension. Each of the boxes with the individual components are the members, and then each of these horizontal lines are the levels of the dimension. So facts are associated with members of the dimension. Again, going back to the example of coordinates, I've got X, Y, and Z for the first five atoms in one of our targets. And all of the atoms are basically associated, or all of these X, Y, Z coordinates are associated with individual atoms. Thus, struct ID 122 and atom number 1 point specifically to this member of the dimension. In addition to coordinates, we have other analyses that are secondary to the trajectories, and they'll point to other member or other levels in the hierarchy. And the answer, there, the point is that any data that you want to associate with this model, you can plug in at any level in the dimensional hierarchy, and it allows you to compare and bring data together for analysis. Okay. Two keywords that you'll hear today, and then is also associated with OLAP and specifically with the multidimensional expression of data, are tuples and sets. So if you have a collection of dimensions and they uniquely identify a fact, this is called a tuple. This is similar to a multidimensional array in a language like C or C#, where in this case I've declared an array. It basically has this set of dimensions. And I've assigned for, in our example, simulation ID 678, struct ID 122, instance 1, residue 2, step 0, et cetera, will uniquely define this angle. So that's kind of where the analogy breaks, though, is that in C and so forth, you're always going to be putting integers, or in some cases, maybe you can do a hash type of implementation. But it's really fixed, and the order of these is significant. In OLAP, the dimensions are self-describing, and so you can basically list them in any order. And the second term here is a set, which is if you look at all of these tuples together, it basically composes a set. So we'll talk a little bit more about that too. Yes.
How sparse is your data?
It's not. Okay. It's not sparse. Although this model was originally designed for sparse data. Okay, so OLAP, and this is actually a good segue to this, because OLAP was originally designed for doing business data, so numbers of widgets, numbers of things sold, amount of money coming in. The idea was that you have these independent entities producing lots of data, and it all gets aggregated at one point where you want to run reports. And again, individual facts as coming from one of these sources are specified by a tuple. If you leave out one portion of the dimension, you kind of end up getting a more complicated a set of things, usually a list or even a subcube. Then choosing a member above the base, remember in the hierarchy, it's kind of a shorthand for all the descendants. This is, again, coming out of the reporting background of this product. So it's like, I'm not interested in the number of sales at such and such store. I want to know it by city or by state or by region or by sales manager. So that's where the level concepts come in. And again, OLAP really wants to do aggregation whenever you're querying data in it. The default aggregation model is sum, which makes a lot of sense for things like widgets and money. It doesn't necessarily make sense for the data that I put in it, but sometimes it works just fine. We'll see that later. Let's move along. So we talked a little bit about what OLAP is, and I want to talk briefly about what it is not. OLAP is really not for managing data, it's for reporting it. It's for reporting, doing analysis, doing mining. OLAP cubes don't care about integrity constraints. You'd asked about sparse data again. OLAP doesn't care. It's perfectly happy to have sales figures missing from three stores for 3 months, and it will still give you a report as the best that it can based on what it has. The second thing is that it's really read-only, so its support for fast updates non-existent. It's basically bringing new data in is a chore. Sparse, missing data, it also doesn't care about that either. It kind of tries to always do the best with what it can. For people who have background in the relational model and SQL, you can think of OLAP as like a materialized view. So it's highly optimized, but it's fixed. It's really read-only. Modifying it is not something you get. All right, so those were all general OLAP concepts. Now I want to talk about some specifics of the implementation that I've been working on. So SQL Server comes with an OLAP product built in. There's a relational database portion called SQL Server, and then Analysis Services is a multidimensional OLAP product, and they all ship in one product called SQL Server. So in Analysis Services, the kind of the base of discourse is a cube. It's again this multidimensional model where you've defined a bunch of dimensions and you have a set of facts and you want to report on them. Relational database is more general purpose. There you're talking about a database composed of tables, and the tables have relationships to each other, and you kind of are modeling at a different level. This slide used to say proprietary and undocumented store. That's not true anymore. I actually found a book that talks about how Microsoft actually implemented their multidimensional store, but it's still proprietary. It's less well known than most SQL implementations, where even if you don't know the specific bits and bytes that occur everywhere in the file, you have an idea that all of your tables are going to be present in some kind of paging structure. You've got some kind of index to access them. In OLAP, you're not there. It's something different. Another big difference between this and the relational model is that they have their own language for querying this information. This is both a good and a bad thing, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Relational databases, of course, and some will claim those at the old intergalactic data speak. Structured query language, or SQL, is the language of choice on the relational side. Next difference. This is a big one, and this will come up later in some of the examples that we'll look at. In OLAP, you have this big structure that's all together. You have this big cube of information. Your job as someone who's looking, either mining data or running a report, is really what you're doing is you're selecting out things from it. So you're coming from the top down to what the information that you want. In SQL, everything goes in the opposite direction. You have this disparate set of tables that have information that have been basically optimized for some purpose, like the transactional system will have small tables that are updated quickly, but then you have other information that's somewhere else, and whenever you're reporting on it, you're really joining those things together and you're kind of building the result set up that you want from the bottom. This is a big deal, and you'll see a little bit more about what the implications are when we look at some actual examples. Result sets. In a cube, the result sets are subcubes. When you pull out one of the dimensions and you say, I want everything across all simulations, where you're going to get all of the dimensions that were there before, except for the one that you decide to let run wild. Results in SQL, of course, are always two-dimensional tables. Everything is always a spreadsheet in concept in SQL. Last point, data are ordered. This is another big one that's a real departure from what people are used to in the relational model. In the relational model, you have sets. Everything is sitting out there. You have to, if you want to do something like an operation like median, it's not going to be built in the language for you because I have a set of data. It's like median is only a valid statistical summary when you know the order of what you're looking at. So everything in cubes is ordered. And so this, again, it's both a good and a bad thing. This is part of the reason why this information is read-only and it has to be built, is because everything is ordered, but at the same time, it makes things really fast. Okay, again, a few more details on analysis services specifically. I mentioned before that these discrete, all the dimensional values are discrete, discrete quantities. They don't have to be integers, but they, anything that can come down a short text string, larger integer quantities, so forth. This means that all indexes in OLAP can be implemented as bit vectors. And this is another thing that can make things really fast, but also contributes to the fact that it's hard to update this data. You effectively compile your data into this very tight structure, and it's very hard to bring new data into it. You have to effectively recompile the information that you're looking at. So again, not good for transactional data, very good for things that are fixed or are read-only. I mentioned the median example already, but again, I can't nail this strongly enough. Everything's ordered in the cube. And then all the speed, though, effectively comes from compiling from other sources. So it's like it's not really a standalone product. It's really only something that makes sense if you have data somewhere else. Okay, last specific point on SQL Server and its implementation. The language is called multidimensional expressions, or MDX. the MDX query is it's a multidimensional query language. So you specify, you give it a cube, you specify what you're looking for, and your result set will be a cube. And the only way that I've really found to demonstrate this is to look at an example. And so let's do that now. Don't worry about all the syntax and so forth of this query. This is actually a little bit longer than what I'd normally want to display, but I want to show you the key pieces. The other thing I'll just make a quick note of right now, SQL has hundreds of statements, things to query, the select statement, things to modify data, things to delete data, things to create tables, tons and tons of language infrastructure. And there's some of that in analysis services, but really, 99% of the time, you're running this one statement. This is where all the action is this one select statement. So anyways, I mentioned four parts. This first part is optional. This is basically taking information that was stored in the dimensional hierarchy and making it available for projecting out into the result set. So you may recall from the example of ENH that I had things like the names of the atoms and the names of the residues and residue numbers and things are all inherent in the dimension. They're not in the facts, but I want to be able to display them in a given report. Second piece is the select statement itself. I mentioned that MDX is inherently something that gives you a multidimensional result set, and so the syntax of the language reflects that. Select takes a series of dimensions and will concoct a cube based on what you tell it. So in this first set, axis 0, that refers to columns, okay? So anything that is listed up here, like atom number, atom type, residue number, and again, with information drawn from the dimensional hierarchy, is going to appear here in the output set. The x, y, and z coordinates, they also get merged together. That's the column side. Then the second side is this axis 1. Well, that's rows. And in this case, what I'm looking at is I've taken a structure. In this case, I happen to know that it's structure 122. And what I want is the first through the fifth atoms only, and I want that as rows. And the other two pieces of the statement, you have to just tell it where you're getting it from. In this case, one hypercube, which is what I prepared for today's lecture. And then the last part is an optional, what they call slicing dimension, which allows you to reduce the amount of information coming back to a specific query of interest. So this defines the structure of what you want to get back. This provides you the ability to map in other information from the dimensions that are not part of facts. This specifies where to get it from, and the where clause allows you to isolate it to a specific piece of information. The where clause is optional. If I were to take that out and run the same query, I would still get something with this set of columns, and I would even get the same set of atoms. But because OLAP loves to aggregate, it would take every simulation that I have loaded, and it would add up all the coordinates, and they would put them right here. Sometimes that's what you want. But in this case, no. Okay, so now let's talk about what I've designed. You recall all the pictures with all the targets and simulations from the first slides. The first step in an OLAP design is picking out the principal dimensions of the data that you're attempting to organize. In this case, I've identified four primary dimensions. One is structure. Those are the structures that we download from the PDB and that we actively simulate. We modify them and simulate them. Second dimension are the simulations themselves. Third, we like to take simulations that are of interest and we group them together. If you look on our website, we put a lot of time into producing what we call the top 807, which happens to be a set of simulations that are for a specific set of proteins that are of interest for bioinformatics mining. In addition to simulations being interesting from a grouping perspective, structures are also interesting. In the case of SNPs, for instance, we like to have a notion of what's the wild type and then what are all the mutants that we've looked at. And so having a structure group provides you a mechanism to say, I want to look at all of COMPT. I want to look at all of DJ1. I want to look at all of these things and show me everything that I want to mine across. And then, of course, I've just shown the dimensions graphically here. As important as the dimensions themselves are the hierarchies within them, this you've already seen it's the same hierarchy as before. In the structure side, there's a concept of atoms, amino acids or residues, chain, and structure. And in a sense, if I want to access anything about 1ENH, if I mention it at this level, I'm seeing all the members below it. If I want to go by atom, I have that option as well. Simulation, similarly organized, except fewer levels. Every turn of the simulation that outputs a structure, we call that a step. And steps have numbers, and they're indicated here. They have a relationship to the time resolution of the structure that we're simulating. Simulations can contain multiple systems, basically multiple proteins. That's accounted for at this level. And then simulations themselves are just assigned identifiers. The secondary dimensions are a little bit special in that everything else in those previous slides you've seen are kind of many-to-one dimensions. It's like you have one structure that branches out to many amino acids that has many atoms below that, and simulation is similar. Groups, though, both the simulation and the structure group, these are many-to-many. Every time we have a simulation, it may be of interest in any number of groups, and we want to be able to collect them together. This is one of the things that OLAP doesn't do as well as a relational database, but it can be done. And for the types of things that we do, where we have maybe 25 interesting groups that we want to either publish or share with another group, that level of cardinality works fine. Same with structures. But if we had like 10 million groups, we might have to rethink about how we're doing this. OK, so I mentioned MDX and OLAP don't really exist on their own. In this case, there's a tight relationship back to the information that's stored in the relational tables. Simulation is kind of one of our major tables in the relational side of the warehouse. And again, simulation ID, this system instance or structure instance, and the structure, and of course the time point. That, in effect, defines the simulation, and there's a table in the warehouse that carries this information, and this design is locked directly to it. Structure, effectively, atom numbers and struct IDs define everything that we ever capture about structures. Again, there are tables back in the main warehouse that support this, and they feed right into that structure dimension. Groups and simulations, these are many-to-many tables, so in SQL or in relational model, if you want that kind of relationship, you end up having table 1 defining your groups, table 2 defining the data that you want to associate, and you make a little joining table to go between them. And effectively, these intermediate tables also get mapped into the OLAP model as something called factless tables. Not important to know, but it's another tie back to the relational model. So that's the dimensional side. What are we left then with as far as the facts that we want to put into this data or into this cube? Atom coordinates, of course, you've seen. Every simulation has a box size. It's basically what the engine is operating over. I bolded this dihedral angles because it's something I'm going to be using as an example. We have a set of other analyses that we call our standard analyses that we typically run whenever we run a simulation, and all of these go into the cube. Well, to make this most clear is to show, and again, this is a key part of the dimensional modeling, is you all know what a coordinate is. There are other things that also exist at the same granularity, meaning that they are associated with specific atoms and steps. Forces is an example. But all of these other facts that we model have different dimensionality. Some things are basically associated with specific structures and time. Other things are not. Like, for instance, this root mean square fluctuation, that's a residue level measurement that's really associated with an entire system in a simulation, not a specific step. So working out the details of all of these links is key to having the eventual cube be something that can actually be queried and yield useful results. Okay. So now we can talk about the actual implementation that you've seen in the design. So a starting point for me was looking at, I wanted to get something where I had enough simulations that would give me an idea of scalability and speed, but I also wanted something that I could turn the crank quickly on. I mentioned before, OLAP is something you have to effectively compile your data into. So I picked a small set, 63 simulations. They happen to be the top six protein targets from our dynamic omics project. 1.5 million structures, about just over a microsecond of simulation time, and 214 gigabytes of raw coordinate storage in the Siebel data warehouse. I've limited it to coordinates, box, and dihedral angles only, again, because I wanted something small enough that I could turn the crank rapidly while I was developing. So this build or processing time, part of the process where you take the data and you compile it into this compact form, is about 2 hours for that data set. So it's enough time that it's you have to think carefully about you know like if it's the morning of your talk, you don't necessarily want to go rebuild your queue and hope that it's done in time. But I didn't do that. And the other thing that becomes clear as soon as you build your first cube, even if you before you've touched it, you know the data that are in it. It is amazingly compact. It's insanely compact. So we're looking at a 75% reduction in space over the representation in SQL. This is something that is extremely important for mining large data sets, and it's also it's very important for performance, because one of the most important things for doing or making fast code in database land is not doing work. Anytime that you're not reading something, you're going to save an incredible amount of time. So my first test was I wanted to find a measure that had a lot of data, not as rich as coordinates, but still had enough to really look at and give me an idea of size and performance. And so I decided to look at one of our standard analyses called dihedral angles. So these are these are measurements of the orientation of the side chains of a protein, and they have implications for conformation study in general, but also they have they can basically help you design proteins as well, because it gives you an idea of how things should be. Okay, one simple visualization technique for once you've captured these data is to make histograms, and you basically bin the angle information that you get into 1-degree bins, and you plot it. In my case, I'm just going to show the raw data. For the test set, we were looking at 855 million rows of dihedral data. So let's take a look at what we had to do to look at it in SQL first. So this is a typical SQL query. Again, this bottom-up concept. The very bottom is determining things like, I basically want to display this information by residue or amino acid. So my first step is to basically give myself a list of struct IDs and residue IDs and residues from this table that happens to contain all of the structural information that's in the warehouse, and make that available for a query. The second piece takes a view that I created, which is basically a union of all of the dihedral data that was run against the set of simulations in my set, and I link the two together. This clause here is actually duplicated 4 more times than what I've shown, because the set of data that I was compiling was actually over multiple databases. The next part above this is I want to now that I've got my ideal list of residues and angles, I want to bin them. That's this cast statement here, where I basically take the angle, I round it up to an integer, and I count the number of rows that are in there, and I pass it up one more level to a final piece of query that pulls out the angle name, residue information, and basically sums the counts that were done earlier. This is very typical SQL programming. There's nothing exciting going on here. It's actually not even that complicated, even though it doesn't fit on the screen. But it's basically this the thing that you're doing all the time in mining a relational warehouse, which is you're taking a bunch of data at one level and you're combining it up through some aggregation and putting the data out. So the first version of this was really slow. In fact, the version that you saw on the previous page, I actually had to do some more optimization to get it to run, even at a time that I thought was reasonable. I stopped it after 3 hours, the first version. I did a slight modification, and I got it down to 32 minutes. The result set is 35,000 rows, and it basically looks like this. You see a residue name, you see an angle name, you see the bin, you see the count. 35,000 rows exactly like this. I'll state right up front, clear full disclosure, I could make this query faster if I wanted to. But this was kind of, I was kind of trying to keep it to what can I put together as a researcher when I just want to answer a question quick, and maybe it's Friday afternoon and I don't care if it runs all weekend, but I want my answer to be correct. Now let's take a look at how I did it in MDX. So again, 65 lines of SQL. You're looking at 6 lines of MDX to do the same thing. This is appealing to me, but it also has like kind of the Lisp trap. Sometimes I would spend, you know, 2 hours looking at one line of Lisp trying to get it to work the way I wanted it. But what is it Iroh always says? It's like the difference, you know, you've been working with coal and now you're working with diamond. That's a little bit of that here. You basically get a lot of bang for the buck in terms of how you can express things. And anything that fits into what OLAP likes to do, which is add up groups of things according to dimensional values, it's really good at that, and it makes it very quick and easy to do. So let's take a look. That's the writing side, definitely quick. This is the part that's really cool. That same amount of data only took 4 seconds to compile. Okay, I mean, that's an absolutely huge increase in performance. Not only was I able to return do that in 6 lines and return it in 4 seconds, I was actually able to get it back in a form that was more suitable for analysis. So in SQL, the best I can do is kind of replicate the table structure that's in the base data, unless at the last moment I want to do a thing called a pivot, which is this hideous statement in transact SQL, or you end up doing a lot more unioning and so forth to kind of build up the result set in the shape that you want. In MDX, I basically told it, well, you know, I want the amino acids across the top, and I want the bins on the side, and give me the values and count them up, and that's it. Very easy, very straightforward, and extremely fast. So dihedral's good, it's a reasonable size data set, but it's not necessarily representative of the most amount of analysis or calculation that we'd want to do on a given simulation or set of simulations. So kind of one of the big analysis that we have to look at is this notion of atom-atom contacts. So in this case, what we're doing is each of those simulation frames, the horse running that you saw earlier, is a set of coordinates. And within those coordinates, it becomes very interesting to know which atoms are close to which other atoms. And it basically comes down to, you know, this rule. Two heavy atoms, basically not hydrogen, they're in contact if they're less than 4.6 angstroms apart, and unless both of them are carbon, and then we make it 5.4. Sounds like a simple thing. Computationally, though, it's very difficult to do efficiently. A brute force comparison of all atoms in a single simulation frame, well, you're going to end up doing a Cartesian product of all the rows in that frame divided by 2, because distance, fortunately, you don't have to look at both sides.
That's your 5 minutes.
Thanks. So the protein that we've been looking at all along and all the little snippets of data at 1 ENH, a single frame is going to be 631,000 comparisons. And there's 31,000 more of those that you'd have to do to go over the entire trajectory. A simple SQL implementation basically involves a self-join on a coordinate table, and it looks something like this. I basically cut out the portion of the cutoffs because I just wanted to show the distance calculation. But in a sense, I've taken the coordinate table, I've joined it to itself, I've made sure that I'm looking at the same simulation ID, the same step, and then if it's a different struct instance, that's in the case if I have multiple proteins in the same simulation, this will still work. And then, of course, if it is in the same structure, don't count yourself, don't give me a bunch of zeros, and then only give me half the matrix. Again, the query isn't that hard, but gosh, it's inefficient. Even though my tables are fully indexed and it's really easy to pull up each of these coordinates, if we run this query across a single simulation, the result set is 36 million rows. Okay, so not huge, but big. That took 2 hours and 26 minutes to run. That's not going to scale to 10,000 simulations. So we've been working on this. This is inherent in our simulation engine, but we've actually been bringing it out for analysis purposes too. Is this thing called Hash3D optimization? And for a problem like contact distances, what you can do is I have this big box, which are all the atoms in the simulation. If I subdivide that big box into a bunch of smaller cubes, each of which are about 5.4 angstroms on a side, I can basically address each one of these as a three-dimensional integer coordinate, which I can actually reduce to one int within a box. So if I then take its 26 friends or neighbors around it, at the time that I'm loading the simulation, I can basically record all of the atoms that are in each of these boxes, and I can record which box they're in, and all of a sudden I've got basically a spatial index coded on an integer for doing interesting things as far as give me all the atoms that are next to each other. Again, it's kind of a gross level filter, but it's okay because really what we want to do is we want to just reduce that number of calculations from the Cartesian product is 600,000. We want to get that down to the ones that where it makes sense to do that calculation. Anyways, you end up with two quantities, the bin you're in and the neighbors you're next to. As I mentioned, we compute those things, we store them at load time. A small little C-sharp stored procedure computes the neighbors next to each other. And if I then apply that to that same query, basically I add one more join clause to the query I showed a minute ago, that two-hour time frame goes down to 36 minutes. So this all of a sudden gets a lot more interesting because I was basically able to make this faster by not doing unnecessary work. And again, all I'd have to do, and the cost that I have to pay as far as storage is I add one int column to every simulation table. So of course the question you're all asking, and the one that I don't have an answer to yet, but I will soon, is can I do this in MDX? Now this is one of the cases where if I was counting something that's in an individual measure, MDX is totally all over this, and it knows how to do that very well. If I'm looking at two things in a measure and I want to compare them, the syntax gets more complicated, everything else gets more difficult. You have to come back and think about, is there a better way to do it, a better way to model it, than what may be the first choice or the intuitive choice when putting it in the model. Since the design's in progress, one thing I was playing with was we had actually done some of this before without using the bin indexing, and I was hoping to resurrect it, but I found that once I had corrected the structures in the cube design, that was no longer working. But I'll have that fixed soon. But the interesting thing is that those bins and neighbors, those are a hierarchy. And so OLAP should be able to deal with this really well. And so my next steps on this are basically to encode those bins and neighbors and build a hierarchy. And I should be able to, I'm not sure if I'll do as well as the improvement in speed of the dihedral query, but I bet it'll be pretty good. We're doing this in conjunction with getting a manuscript out on the Hash3D approach. And this will be a nice, a nice way to wrap it up is to add the information about how this affects OLAP queries as well. Okay, so let's see if we can finish up. I know I've covered a lot of stuff today. I have low expectations when it comes to data tools these days. Most tools, that even the really slick ones, when they tell me that, we can do all this stuff, we can plot all this and whatever, and I give them one coordinate trajectory and they choke. So my expectations are low. But the minute that something meets this minimum boundary, I'm a lot happier. The first thing is that OLAP seems to be able to handle data volumes that I'm throwing at it. And when the queries are in the model that OLAP supports, they are insanely fast. Storage, I'm not paying a big penalty for, I still have to keep the other versions of the data around, unfortunately. But I'm not paying a huge penalty of like doubling or tripling that storage, which is really good. Certain classes of queries also on the good side, they're trivial to write. If they fit into this model of, if you can think of it in terms of, counting widgets or sales, it's going to be really easy to write and it's going to be very, very straightforward. On the downside, when you're not doing this, MDX syntax is really complicated. Even worse, it shares keywords but not semantics with SQL. So as a SQL person, I look at these things and I'm just like, it really gets confusing fast. The processing and initial setup time are non-trivial. I mean, this is a nice set that's 63 simulations, but when I go and give this all 807, I'm probably looking at 3 or 4 days every time I want to turn that crank. So that's not good. The other thing is documentation has been a problem in the past, even though there's some better books and things now. You're kind of on your own if you use this product. Okay, final conclusions and future directions. Again, the OLAP and relational models, they're complementary. You know, SQL can stand on its own. OLAP really can't, but it really complements SQL functionality nicely. I think I'm going to be spending a lot more time tuning things to maximize performance. I know how to do that in SQL. It's not as obvious in OLAP because a lot of things are hidden, a lot of the details and so forth. But now that I have a little bit more information and I have some more data that I can look at, I suspect that if the more that I can map the types of questions, scientific questions that we want to ask into the OLAP model, I will get insanely fast answers. Next steps, as I mentioned before, I need to get that OLAP design, including the Hash3D optimization, up and going. And I really need to do some additional performance and scale testing. So with that, I just have a couple of quick acknowledgments. Amanda's here, Rudesh is not. They've both really been really helpful in getting the data together for this presentation. And of course, the rest of the Daggett lab, most of whom are sitting right here. And then with that, I'll open it up to any questions.
So you've talked about the designing the queue and all the thought that goes into that. So as far as exploring data, if you have, say I have a sense in SQL, you kind of have all the pieces there combined anyway. Maybe that's an illusion, but if you're building a queue towards what you know you want to analyze already, great, it looks like it works really fast.
Yeah.
If you don't have a good sense of what you want to analyze, is that a queue where to go, or do you still see it working in SQL?
I think that's a really good question. There's some, I would say that on a level of classifying general questions, like in terms of, I want to do something across every pair of atom coordinates, okay? I don't know exactly what that something is, but I want to be able to read those all in and apply some transformation to them. I want to add them up. I want to do some kind of statistical summary. I think you can do a lot of exploration given a fairly generic cube very quickly and easily. But if you're really off in the weeds with what you want to do, and you kind of break away from what's encoded in the model, SQL is probably going to be easier. It may not be faster, but at least it'll get you started more quickly. The other interesting thing that brings up is that, and this has come up in terms of trying to help people. We let people on the outside access some of our data, and so it's always interesting. Like 2 weeks ago, I got this great email saying, "We've been trying to get connected. We can't get anything. Don't you guys have an FTP site?" You know. And you're like, okay, boy, that's going to be a tough one to get over. In the OLAP world, I can kind of hide some of the structural details. I can condense it down to some very high level things that people, you know, are going to understand. They know they're thinking about structures. They know they're thinking about time. It might look a little simpler to them than giving them, you know, basically a big schema diagram and say, have at it. I'm not sure yet, but it's. I think there's some possibilities there. Jim?
Specific questions. But you said it took about 2 hours to build the thing from the relational database.
Yeah.
What if you have one new record in the database, you have to rebuild the whole thing?
For adding things in what's called a partition, you can actually do that incrementally. So if you, like the question that we've been working on is we extend simulations all the time. So in a sense that, you know, we've run them to like 31 nanoseconds, and then someone says, hey, you know what, we want to look longer, so let's take it to 40 or 50. And so in that case, you're basically stretching each individual coordinate table and its associated analyses. That doesn't quite fit into the partition model of OLAP. So it becomes one of those, you know what, you're going to have to build it again from scratch. If instead what you're doing is, well, you know what, I've loaded my first 63 simulations, and now I want to load another, you know, 400 more, as long as they don't intersect, I can slide in that partition and not have to rebuild the dimensional structure or the previous things that were built before. So in that sense, I can do it. So I'm going to be thinking a lot more about how to do extensions more easily, because it's, you know, right now it's been more of a problem if we changed our schema. And then I definitely have to rebuild. But doing you know, adding, like you say, even a row of data, I don't want to pay that. I don't want to pay a week penalty, you know, to regenerate my data.
Also, are there any open source implementations of OLAP?
There are a couple, but they're not. There was one that I saw 2 years ago that looked, like a reasonable gradware project, but I haven't seen anyone produce any results from it other than the original paper that talked about it.
I think it'd be interesting for other areas like translational research, discovery,
things like that. Yeah. Something else that I haven't talked about is in a sense, the OLAP model is a useful exploration tool in its own. It also comes with a bunch of data mining tools that once you have the data, it's really trivial to go apply. They have a couple of clustering algorithms, they have a couple of other algorithms that, again, once it's in there, you basically have point-and-click access to a number of mining algorithms that you can use quickly and easily once it's in there. Other questions? Thanks, everyone, for coming. Appreciate it.
Thanks.